Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Nuala McGovern. The actor Donald Sutherland has died at the age of 88. Here he is speaking to the BBC in 2011 about his acting career.
Not a conventional Hollywood star. Would that be fair, do you think?
Well, I can tell you, I was walking across the tarmac of a Glasgow airport and a young Scottish air hostess stopped in front of me through the mist, and she said, "Oh, you're Donald Sutherland, aren't you? You're not near as ugly as you are on the telly." And so, yes.
And we'll have more on the life and legacy of Donald Sutherland in about 20 minutes' time. But we begin in Sudan, where it is now more than a year since civil war erupted following a power struggle between the Sudanese Armed Forces, or the SAF, and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, the RSF. And now 14 months on, some of the figures that are associated with this conflict are staggering. There are over 6 million people that have been displaced within the country. At least 1.5 million people have fled across Sudan's borders. Those figures are according to the UN's Refugee Agency, and we will hear from their High Commissioner Filippo Grandi shortly. But the conflict, which originated in the capital Khartoum, continues to spread. In the Sudanese region of Darfur, the city of El Fasher, where hundreds of thousands of civilians fled hoping for safety, are now trapped. And it's because the Rapid Support Forces have been trying to capture El Fasher from the army for over a month. Tanzil is from that city and she still has family there. She described the situation to the BBC from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Basically, my entire family there in El Fasher, my parents and my grandmothers and my cousin who all of us grew up together. So they're still there now. We are all just like prepared to hear something bad. Maybe like my dad is dead. Someone's very, 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 I know is dead. And it happened. I mean, my mom lost her brother like 1 week ago. And he was dead for 2 days and nobody knew about that, because there's no internet connection. Even his family, they don't know. And they start searching for the hospitals and everything. And then it happened that a sniper shot him with another military, like a soldier. And then the military people, they took his body and they buried him. So it was not easy to find him, basically. Nobody knew. We didn't even give him like this proper burial. A guy from the military told him that, yeah, we found this guy. He was dead next to one of our soldiers. So we took them and buried him because he was already dead and everything. So that's it. He just died. I'm sorry for my mom. Basically, everyone in El Fasher, they are targeted if the RSF, they took over. Because, so basically, El Fasher, the majority, they are these black African tribes. So if the RSF, they took over, it's like, it's a crisis for all of us, basically. I'm a black African tribe. And, but my major concern is that, like, maybe the attack happens and my father is outside trying to find the Wi-Fi to talk to us and reassure us, like, that they are fine, and then he will get stuck. And you never know. And basically, our house, like 4 days ago, it was somehow bombed. So my father had to leave with the other family, and they just scattered everywhere in some relative's house. Like, he sent my grandma this way, and my cousin this way, and some of my brothers, like, this way. And nobody now in our house, and there's lots of snipers in the neighborhood. And even yesterday, I was just like, that was the time that I talked to my father, and then he told me that the military checkpoint, they stopped him. Because they thought that he is an RSF person, because our house used to be like a big tall building. So they thought that maybe he's hosting a sniper, but basically the sniper is in another building. So they are just living in the neighborhood, shooting people. So if you go the wrong direction, you will be shot. That's why, like, I always worry about my father, because he is the one taking the initiative of giving us the news, because he knows that we are worried. I mean, like, me and my sister, like, both of us are outside. So he's trying to always find a way to go and tell us that they are alive.
That's Tanzil. She is from the city of El Fasher in the Sudanese region of Darfur. And as you heard her say, she still has family there. A little earlier, I spoke to Filippo Grandi. He is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. He has just been to Sudan and I asked him what he had seen.
More displacement, a huge number of people streaming into the relatively stable areas of the country from those areas that are engulfed in the civil war. Khartoum, the Darfur states, the Kordofan states. And of course, this huge displacement is a big burden on the country. The schools have been closed for more than a year, so there's no education given to Sudanese children. Hunger is rising in many parts of the country because of the difficulties in providing food. And of course, what we hear from refugees coming out of the war areas is the most abysmal reports of human rights violations, like rape of women, forced recruitment of children, armed people coming into houses and for extortion or theft of goods, of money. The reality on the ground is that the war is fragmenting into a myriad armed groups controlling each one a portion of the territories and affiliated more or less loosely to the two big groups, the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces. The war is becoming much more complex and much more dangerous as well.
I did see this week that Sudan accused the United Arab Emirates of arming the rapid support forces, the RSF that you've mentioned there that have been fighting Sudan's army. It was the UAE ambassador then responded, calling Sudan's charge ludicrous. Do you have any comment on that?
No, I do not make comments on responsibilities of individual states, but we all know that both sides receive weapons and support from different countries. And what we have been saying is that, quite on the contrary, those with influence on those two factions should use that influence to push them back to the negotiating table. This has not happened.
No, it has not happened. And this has been taking place, the conflict in its latest iteration, since April 2023. Obviously, Ukraine has been in the headlines, Gaza, Israel. Why do you think Sudan has not been on that path of negotiation in the way that some might have expected at this point?
I think there has been pressure. Of course, the US, the Saudi government have attempted a mediation effort, but clearly the priorities internationally have been elsewhere. This has not been a priority crisis. Now, there could be many, many different reasons, perhaps even a certain fatigue for crises in Africa that never seem to end, like Eastern Congo, for example, some of the conflicts in the Sahel. The reality is that even leaving aside the angle of the war that I deal with, the human suffering, which is unspeakable and enormous, you know, 9 million people displaced, only to look at UNHCR angle in this crisis, this is profoundly destabilizing for a very important part of Africa and has ramifications that go well beyond Sudan itself, which alone is a very big country. So it's difficult to grasp why it doesn't capture more attention. The reality is it doesn't. And this translates, by the way, into relatively limited financial support for humanitarian operations, which, of course, that way cannot reach all the people in need.
Can you elaborate on what you said there, though, that there might be a certain fatigue with African conflicts?
It's sad to say, but it is true. I simply say this out of experience. Many of our humanitarian operations, our meaning UNHCR, but also the operations in which the humanitarian community is involved, are in Africa. And yet they are the ones least funded, and they are the ones for which a political solution appears most difficult to obtain. They are complex, granted, but so are other conflicts. And yet they seem to receive a bit more attention. I have to also tell you, having said all this, that even with that attention put on those conflicts, solutions seem to be extremely scarce and far apart. We've just put out our yearly report. We call it Global Trends of Displacement, 120 million refugees and displaced. This is a figure that has been going up for 12 consecutive years. And why? And that's because you know, attention or not attention, political solutions, which is really the only way to address this crisis, are not forthcoming.
I was reading part of your report, and one line struck me that you had, which was, let's make refugee inclusion the norm. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that we should all agree that the best solution for refugees, for displaced people, is to go back to their homes. And by the way, contrary to many perceptions, this is what most refugees want. This is why most of the refugees are in countries with few resources. They're actually near the country of the conflict, like here in Sudan. The refugees are here in South Sudan or in Chad or in Ethiopia or in Egypt. But this return home is only possible if you have peace. So in the meantime, big numbers of refugees are staying in countries where traditionally we would help them by creating separate parallel programs for them. Those programs are not sustainable anymore. Humanitarian assistance tends to dry up very quickly in crisis. So what we're now saying to countries is include refugees in your services. Let's try to create conditions for them to become more self-reliant. But because these countries are relatively poor, if not very poor, like here in South Sudan or in Chad, the international community has to help that country carry out that type of inclusion.
And Chad, you mentioned, they're now hosting 1.1 million refugees, making it Africa's largest host per capita. But, you know, there's some alarming headlines that no doubt you've seen over the past day or so, and they refer to Al-Fashir in North Darfur, some worrying that there might be a return to what happened over 20 years ago there. What are your thoughts on that particular area?
Look, all of this will require investigations when they're possible. But I can tell you, I've been to Chad and I've seen refugees, including from Al-Fashir, by the way, in my visit to Sudan yesterday and here in South Sudan and in other places. The stories we hear from them are very similar to the terrible stories of Darfur 20 years ago. Rape, mutilations, targeted violence, recruitment of children. These are the stories that we heard 20 years ago, and many are ethnically based, just like 20 years ago. I think this is really something that would deserve more attention. I remember the outcry because of the Darfur crisis 20 years ago. We don't see anything like this now. There's a sense almost of immunity for this horrible report. Now, you see, what worries me most is that the big players in this war, the Sudanese army and the RSF, their language, their posture is the only solution is a military one. When this is the posture, the result is a very protracted conflict with neither side winning, neither side taking control, but a devastating impact on civilians. And this fragmentation of the war, these many, many affiliated groups controlling territory, are just going to make this much worse. So it's very worrying at the moment.
That was Filippo Grandi, UN High Commissioner for Refugees, speaking to me earlier from Juba, the capital of South Sudan. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Coming up, the Australian journalist Cheng Lei, who was jailed in China for more than 3 years on life outside prison.
I'm stronger and better than ever before. I have lots of reasons to live better, not bitterly. And I try to do justice to freedom in everything. The worst day in freedom is better than the best day in detention.
We'll be hearing her story in 30 minutes' time. Also, headlines this hour, a row between Israel and its closest ally, the United States, has deepened, with Washington describing comments by Benjamin Netanyahu as disappointing and incorrect. You're listening to NewsHour Live from the BBC in London. I'm Nuala McGovern. On Wednesday, the spokesperson for Israel's Defence Forces, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, said in a TV interview that anyone who thinks they can eliminate Hamas is wrong.
Hamas is an idea. Hamas is rooted in Gaza residents' hearts. In order to remove it, to replace those who handle the civic services, those who distribute food or steal it, there should be something else which can emerge. It's the political echelon's decision, and the military will fulfill it. As long as we won't do it, there would be Hamas. Hamas won't disappear from Gaza. It won't disappear.
Eliminating Hamas has been one of the aims of the Israeli government since they launched attacks in Gaza. There were statements following Mr. Hagari's TV appearance from the government and also from the IDF, and they appeared to align both parties with the goal of destroying Hamas's military and governance capabilities. But some have seen the TV incident as illustrative of the tension between the Prime Minister and the military when it comes to actions in Gaza. Jonathan Conricus is a former spokesperson for the IDF. He's now with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. And I asked him if he agreed with the comments by Rear Admiral Hagari.
I agree with the content, and I think that he is quite correct in saying it, that the content is correct. I do not, however, think that the timing is wise, and I regret the fact that these comments, as correct as they are seen as a boost for troop morale on the Hamas side, where they seek to strengthen themselves by saying that even the Israeli military believes that Hamas cannot be totally defeated or replaced. And there's, of course, been a lot of the words taken out of context and distorted. But since you did well enough and you actually had the Hebrew source material and the correct translation, I think that his words were correct, but probably not the best thing for an Israeli spokesperson to say.
But do you think that it does illustrate, as some are saying, this tension that's there in Israel that will bubble up even if you feel the timing wasn't correct or perhaps the place to say them?
Yeah, well, of course there is tension. Israel is a nation at war. We're actively fighting on four fronts. There are more than 100,000 Israeli refugees. There's no real end in sight. We're encircled, surrounded by Iranian proxies, and we're fighting for our very existence. So obviously there will be tensions, and sometimes frustrations built up over many months will make their way through places where they're not supposed to be. And I think that there are tensions, and they are part and parcel of, I think, any military and government. What is different here is that in addition to that, what we have is a political campaign that is ongoing from Jerusalem that is more focused on a blame game. And I think that the remarks made by Admiral Hagari were part of an effort by the IDF to kind of set limits to the extent that the IDF will be targeted in terms of internal politics and blame gaming.
What about the point, though? I'd be curious for your take on it, Jonathan, of Mr. Hagari's, that something else, something other than Hamas, needs to emerge if Hamas is to be, and I'll put it in inverted commas, eliminated.
Yeah, well, that's really clear. For there to be a
day
after
that be?
Gaza.
Yeah, but what would that be?
Well, I think we all, most people around the world, and I think that Israelis and Gazans would probably be much, much better off by Hamas not existing in Gaza, not holding them hostage, and not having the ability to threaten Israeli civilians. That would make for a much more peaceful future for all of us. And I think that Admiral Hagari's comments are quite correct in the sense that if Hamas as an institution, as a sovereign of an area, isn't replaced by another organization, political system that has boots on the ground, financial capabilities, governance, and legitimacy, then all of the campaign, the lives lost, and the resources spent will not have achieved the strategic aim. And I think that what he's trying to say, the bottom line is, dear elected government, we, the IDF, will do everything needed. What we need is a strategy, and what we want are alternatives in order to turn military achievements into a strategic reality the day after.
Jonathan Conricus there, former spokesperson for the IDF, and now with the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. Well, over the past few hours, we have heard the news, the sad news, that Donald Sutherland, a prolific actor whose career in film and television spanned more than six decades, has died at the age of 88. His first starring role as the irreverent army surgeon, that was Hawkeye Pierce in the pitch black anti-comedy MASH, made him one of the great off-kilter leading men of the 1970s.
Are you a beer drinker, sir? Would you like to share a martini with me?
Martini? I'd love a martini.
I think you will find these accommodating. They're quite dry.
Don't you use olives?
We do have to make certain concessions to the war. We're 3 miles from the front line. And
yes, but a man can't really savor his martini without an olive, you know.
Some of the voices, if you're a fan of MASH there, you will recognise Donna Sutherland and speaking to Elliot Gould. Well, to hear more about Mr. Sutherland, we're with Chris Hewitt, editor and host of Empire Film Podcast. Welcome, Chris.
Good evening.
I don't know whether you're a fan of MASH, but yes. It's just one of the credits, of course. He has more than 200 credits to his name.
Yes.
What do you think his legacy is as an actor?
His legacy, I honestly think he's one of the greats of off-screen acting, certainly of the last 50, 60 years. He was so incredibly versatile. There was nothing he could not do. He could play straight-laced. He could play oddball. He literally played a character called Oddball in Kelly's Heroes the same year as MASH, opposite Clint Eastwood. He could be heroic. He could be villainous. He could be unsettling and creepy. He could pretty much do anything he wanted to do. And it was a real pleasure watching him, watching his career develop over the years. It was an actor I grew up absolutely adoring.
Was there anything in particular?
The movies that you've mentioned already, the sort of anti-war movies that he was drawn to, he was very conscientious in real life. So MASH and Kelly's Heroes are definitely in that category. The Dirty Dozen is pretty much where I first saw him, along with a horror film called Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, in which he's great. But he was one of the breakthroughs and the breakout stars of the Dirty Dozen. One of the very last members of that cast to pass away, actually. And he's so great in that as a sort of callow youth. And it was fascinating to watch the way his career developed, because he became a big star very, very quickly after that. He was starring in MASH and Kelly's Heroes within about 3 years after that. And the 70s was really his decade. He became this extraordinary off-kilter, as you say earlier on. That was the absolute perfect description of him, this extraordinary off-kilter leading man who just made a string of classics in the 70s, Klute and Don't Look Now, which I think a lot of people would say was his masterpiece, alongside Julie Christie, Nick Rogue's film. Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the remake, one of the most chilling endings of all time. I don't want to spoil it to people, but he's a man who could make simply pointed at another human being absolutely terrifying. And even though his star perhaps waned in the 1980s and the 1990s, he became this incredibly dependable character actor, and he was spellbinding in a 10-minute cameo appearance in Oliver Stone's JFK.
Can I ask you, just in our last 15 seconds, you met him. What was he like?
He was a funkier, warm, wise, and I had a great time with him. He was fantastic.
And, of course, just even some of the photographs that they have. Avuncular is such a good word to describe him. Thanks so much for spending some time with us, Chris. That's Chris Hewitt. He is the editor and host of Empire Film Podcast, and Donald Sutherland, who has died, sadly, at the age of 88. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service.
I'm Cressy Twigg from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we are asking, is the Islamic State group a threat once more? 10 years since they declared the establishment of a caliphate, the jihadists are claiming to be behind a spate of recent terror attacks.
You cannot ignore the danger of IS. When you're not looking, they will rebound and regroup.
The Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring looks at the world through the lens of its media. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Ecuador was hit by a nationwide blackout on Wednesday, a senior government minister said, leaving some 18 million people in the dark for several hours. It affected homes, hospitals, as well as the capital's traffic lights and even its metro system. This is the latest in a series of energy issues that have hit the country, with blame for them appointed to various sectors, depending on who you speak to. Isabel Ponce is a journalist and editorial director of the independent media outlet GK City.
So yesterday we have a national outage, a blackout that was completely unannounced. It was in the afternoon and I was in a meeting, in a video call, and it just ended. We have people in different parts of the city and also people that has family in different cities. So they were all saying, like, it seems it's a national blackout. But on Sunday, we also had an outage in Quito and other cities that was also unannounced. And it's part of a context that in April, we had outage of 4 to 8 hours daily in some parts of the country because of this crisis.
So this is something that you're becoming used to, if that's the correct term, because before we came on air, you said, you know, if the power goes, the interview will end. But what was the reason for the blackouts? I saw the public works minister was blaming the issue on a lack of investment in electrical systems.
The crisis started actually last year. Mm-hmm. The first reason that the government gave at the beginning was there was no rain. Also in Colombia and other countries in the region, there had similar problems. So it seemed logical.
But the lack of rain because there's hydroelectric power?
Exactly. The majority of our power in Ecuador comes from hydroelectrics. So it has always been linked to rain. But I would say, like, funny part is that on Sunday, when there was this outage that was not announced, the minister said, now we have too much rain. And it has caused, like, this kind of mud blocking rocks that also affected the hydroelectrics. But yesterday, there was another cause that the power transmission lines failed, but they didn't give a reason why they failed. But it seems, as you asked me, this lack of investment is pretty obvious. As Ecuador, we've been from crisis to crisis, literally. We haven't recovered economically from the effects of the pandemic, to national huge strikes that paralyze the country. Then we have also the violence and insecurity crisis. So this instability, it's also a reason for the crisis.
Are people preparing in any way for potential blackouts?
It's hard to do it. But for instance, we as a media, we do service content, how to take care of home appliances, for instance, because you can lose your refrigerator or your laundry, you know, all the things that can be affected. It's like you try to be prepared, but it's not possible if there's not an announcement, a previous announcement.
Isabel Ponce from the Ecuadorian capital, Quito. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Nuala McGovern. The relationship between Washington and Beijing has improved in recent months, according to the US ambassador in Beijing. In a wide-ranging interview with Nicholas Burns, who spoke to the BBC about the difficulties facing the relationship from Taiwan and the South China Sea, he also spoke about potential Chinese interference in US elections. Mr. Burns also reiterated previous warnings from Washington that China's support for Russia's invasion of Ukraine will not be tolerated by the West. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker spoke to him in Beijing, and she began by asking him how Chinese officials react when he speaks to them about the issue of Ukraine.
They contest the facts. We have the right facts. We know exactly what's happening. We know what's being shipped by Chinese companies. We know the impact it's having, the ability of Russia to conduct this war. And so we're absolutely sure of our facts, and the Chinese ought to own up to this. We have sanctioned a great number of Chinese companies, and we're prepared to do more, by the way. We remind China, the Chinese officials, they have considerable authority in this authoritarian government, and they can certainly crack down on these companies, and they ought to do it because it is a major problem, and it's a major, obviously a major assistance to Russia in this war effort.
In terms of conducting diplomacy here in China with officials on a daily basis, how much communication is there between the two sides, and how difficult is it for you?
I've been here for 2+ years. There have been times when communication's been very sparse. After Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, August 2022, the Chinese shut down communications, mostly with our cabinet level in Washington, after that strange balloon floated across the territory of the United States for 5 days. In February of 2023, the Chinese shut down communication. But I think in recent months, it's been relatively better. President Biden had a constructive meeting with President Xi in San Francisco back in November. And since then, the Chinese have agreed to increase our military-to-military communications. That's really critical for us because our militaries are operating in very close proximity to each other in the Spratlys, Paracels of the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, in the Taiwan Strait. You want to have communication because the last thing we want is an accident or misunderstanding that leads to conflict. We're very focused on reducing the probability of a conflict.
In terms of the Taiwan Strait, I mean, the U.S. sending aid, do you think that increases tensions in the Taiwan Strait?
No, I don't, because I think that the United States, under the Taiwan Relations Act of January 1979, has an obligation, a legal obligation, to provide defensive technology to Taiwan. And obviously, we want that to be, have a deterrent effect. And our major advice to the government in China is it must commit itself to a peaceful resolution. I'm not aware of any country in this region who thinks it would be a good idea for China to try to resort to force.
Right now, the U.S. is undergoing another U.S. presidential election. We're seeing two candidates vying to be tough on China. But in terms of national security, we heard from Secretary Blinken in April that there were concerns that China may interfere in the election. How concerned is the U.S. about this, and what actions are taken?
We're very concerned about it. We've warned the Chinese not to involve themselves in our election in any way, shape, or form. You've seen statements by our FBI director in public and by other security officials in the United States pointing to cyber aggression by the Chinese authorities against the United States and against our infrastructure. This is a very serious issue. We've made the same warnings to the Russian Federation not to get involved and try to influence our election by nefarious means.
In terms of what you hope the future of the relationship between the U.S. and China will be, it's hard at the moment, it's getting much better, but how do you improve the situation, especially when it comes to people-to-people concerns?
I think we've got to start with the realization that this is going to be a very competitive, very difficult rivalry between these two countries for a long time to come. It's important to bring our people together, too. This was a very big relationship over the last 40 years. We had 15,000 American students here in China a number of years ago. Now we're down to about 800 American students.
Do you hope to increase that?
Well, we hope so. But, you know, we've got to be concerned about a number of factors.
There's still a level 3 alert on China, which is,
there is a level 3.
People to kind of reconsider their travel.
Yes, China is under, there's a travel advisory level 3. And level 3 means reconsider travel, meaning you have to consider all the factors.
So if you want more people-to-people contact, isn't that kind of contradictory, having that level 3 alert in place?
It's not contradictory. It's meant to allow Americans to make an intelligent decision about whether they should travel. And in the case of why it's level 3, there are Americans in prison here who we believe are wrongfully detained, wrongfully prosecuted. I've been visiting these prisoners, and we want them released. Second, there are a great number of Americans who are subject to what they call exit bans, meaning they can't leave China. I should also say the Chinese have agreed to make people-to-people contacts a priority. But since the San Francisco summit, there have been 61 separate incidents when the security forces or another government ministry here prevents Chinese citizens from participating in our public diplomacy programs or prevents people from traveling to the United States to participate in some of the joint venture trips that we have. And so it's contradictory to the commitments they've made to us. And it's these conflicting signals that are being sent.
The U.S. ambassador to Beijing, Nicholas Burns, is speaking to the BBC's Laura Bicker. Let us move on now, however, to Kenya and to what's been called a different type of protest taking place there. Young people took to the streets after organising online, hoping to force the government to back down on its plans to raise taxes. Here's a little of some of the people who came out earlier.
I'm so upset because of this finance bill. We are here because of our kids. We are here because of our parents. We are really suffering. And for sure, we are really, really tired.
We are much disappointed, and I want to say that as Gen Z, we won't retire, we won't relent.
Remove everything in the finance bill. We are tired as a youth. We support our parents, and we want our parents to look at us and say, we are proud of you because you are standing for what is right.
I spoke to the BBC's Anne Soy, who is in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, and I asked her, who are the protesters?
They're called Gen Zs, young Kenyans who have mobilized themselves on social media. And then finally they get to meet on the streets. On Tuesday they started in Nairobi, and then it has spread across the country, including the president's own backyard in Eldoret in Western Kenya. And the message to the government is very clear. They say that they're opposed to proposals by government to hike taxes because they say the cost of living is already very high. However, in the evening, the members of parliament who had been debating it, taking it through the second reading, passed it to go on to the next stage, which is the committee of the full house, of the whole house. There was disappointment in the end that despite all the noise they have made, the MPs did not listen to what the young people were saying.
And what does the government say? Why do they think these tax hikes are necessary?
The government says that the economy is under strain because of a huge debt burden, and it's taking up more than 60% of its revenue, leaving very little for development projects. And therefore, it has been looking for avenues to raise revenue. The way the Ruto administration has been doing it is by raising more taxes, coming up with new taxes, for instance, something called the housing levy, which is 1% of income tax that is meant to build affordable housing. It's been more and more and more taxes since he took over, and finally young people are saying it is enough, we can't take it anymore.
What about the relationship between the police and the young people on the streets that you saw today?
Well, the police did what they have always done in this country, which is to come out in anti-riot gear with water cannons and tear gas. And, you know, they were lobbing tear gas throughout the day at these young people. And it's very interesting that I've now just discovered that they came up with creative ways of dealing with the effects of tear gas. I was just wondering how they could endure all the tear gas that was being thrown at them and not running away. They stayed put, and, you know, it's surprised many of us who were tearing up, just wanting to run away. And they stayed resolute. It's very interesting because it's a different kind of a protest. I've covered many protests in the past. They've tended to turn violent with looting and throwing stones. But today there wasn't any of that. And because they had agreed amongst themselves on social media that they were going to observe a code of conduct. And they did actually arrest those who attempted to steal and handed them over to the police. So they are trying to do things differently. However, the police are used to doing dealing with protests using excessive force, and that is what we saw today in Nairobi.
The BBC's Anne Soy. Cargo from the remains of the oldest shipwreck to be found in the deep sea has been discovered in the eastern Mediterranean. It was Israeli archaeologists that brought attention to it. So how significant is it? Well, Dr. Sean Kingsley is a marine archaeologist. He's also the editor of Wreck Watch magazine.
It's been an interesting day. The social media and their emails have been going crazy. Well, it's been an open secret. There's a lot of shipwrecks in the deep seas there, but we just didn't know what they were. And then suddenly, bang, there's this expose. One shipwreck dating to about 1300, 1400 BC. And, you know, that period is incredibly important and interesting because it's the cradle of Mediterranean trade. It's when all these systems of trading and building ships took off and set the scene for the next 1800 years. And you layer over that, that we're the dawn of the age of the Bible, and that makes it incredibly exciting.
So I'm looking at some pictures online. I'm probably mispronouncing this word. You'll help me, Sean. Ancient amphorae, like these kind of vessels or casks, I guess I'd call them. how could they have survived all this time?
Well, they're made from pottery, and pottery is virtually indestructible. Now, we know about 100 shipwrecks off the coast of Israel. And the problem there is they're all in very shallow water, so they hit these sandbanks and explode. And all the hull breaks up and the pottery vessels do break up. But here we are, 90 kilometers offshore. And, you know, you're going through the water column, the ship has wrecked, and it just actually very softly and almost like quite poetically lands on the seabed. And everything around it, the upper part of the ship has dissolved, but the pottery will just be there forever.
And so what are you most excited about with this discovery?
I am most excited about what lies beneath. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing in these cool photos of these amphora and one stone anchor is only 1% of the picture. 99% of the picture is still under the mud. So the big question for me is, can we actually excavate a wreck down at 1,800 meters? And what is in the amphoras? We don't know. Is it wine? Is it beads? Is it olives? Is it pistachio shrubs? Which we
is
know
we're
in this kind of amphoras. Now, don't go there. But it's funny you say that, because a wreck of similar date was excavated at Uluburun off Turkey, and it had everything you could dream of on it, from amphoras to pomegranates to incredible Canaanite gold Jurian statuettes. So yes, you do find gold, but the treasure is in the story and in the archaeology, of course. And right down at the bottom of the hull, there could be and probably is copper and tin ingots from Cyprus and Uzbekistan.
So now you're excited about it too. Dr. Sean Kingsley managed to give us some ideas about why that find is just so significant. He's a marine archaeologist and also the editor of Wreck Watch magazine. Thanks to him. This is Nuala McGovern with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Relations between Australia and China have been pretty frosty for the past few years. Trade disputes, allegations of Chinese spying and influence peddling, and Australia calling for an international inquiry into the origins of COVID-19. However, the frost began to thaw a little this week with a visit to Canberra by the Chinese Premier, that's Li Qiang, the first such visit for 7 years. But it was overshadowed by an incident at a news conference between Mr. Li and the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, when officials from the Chinese embassy tried to stand in front of a well-known Australian journalist. That was Cheng Lei, who was sat with the assembled throng of reporters. Cheng Lei became something of a cause célèbre when she was detained in China, that was back in 2020, and only released in October of last year. She had been working as a business reporter for China's state-run English language TV station, CGTN, and was accused of illegally supplying state secrets overseas. Speaking to my colleague, James Menendez, from our home in Melbourne, Cheng Lei began with that tense moment earlier this week.
I was attending the joint signing of agreements, and while sitting in the second row, because I'm guessing the Chinese state TV camera angle would have caught me behind the ministers, the Chinese ministers, and also perhaps for fear of international news outlets panning the camera from the two leaders to me, two Chinese embassy officials tried to stand between myself and the cameras. When another journalist swapped seats with me, then the other official tried to stand on my other side.
Do you think it was partly an attempt to intimidate you in some way?
Partly, and at least to show me that someone was there to stop me if I tried something funny. Not that I would have.
Because you were just there as a reporter.
That's right. And it was very exciting for me because this is the biggest Sino-Australian story of the year. And I am reporting it in a place of freedom.
Did Australian officials get involved to try and help you, or at least try and move the Chinese officials along?
Yes. In fact, you can see very clearly in the videos, there's even a bit of pushing by the Chinese embassy media officer. And despite repeated requests, there was no movement. It was very distracting, and it did remind me of being in RSDL, which is residential surveillance at a designated location, where for 6 months I had two guards to stand next to me and sit next to me at all times.
What do you think the Chinese authorities now are worried about? I mean, you talked about that they possibly worried that you might say something or there might be an outburst, but is it more than that? Is it something about what you might symbolise to them?
I think it's probably multiple reasons, but as someone who used to work inside the system, albeit the English arm, I know that for each of these state visits, there's a set script. The motorcade, the military band, the effusive welcome, and all the pomp and ceremony. And they did not want anything else. Then there is the fact that I do symbolize bad times that they wish would go away.
For the benefit of our listeners, why were you detained and held in the conditions that you just described? I mean, the sort of official line was that it was endangering Chinese national security, spying effectively. But was there an incident that triggered your arrest, do you think?
It did happen around the time of deterioration in bilateral relations. Australia had asked unilaterally for China to be investigated as the source of COVID. China retaliated by putting out travel advisory warnings. Then the surveillance on me started right around that time. Nobody from China is going to deny or confirm one way or another. We can only draw our own conclusions. But hostage diplomacy is not something that China shies away from.
Yeah, from all that you say, I mean, they were looking for a reason to use you as a political pawn. Is that fair?
I'd say so.
And why do you think you were released?
The government changed. And also we had a lot of public sympathy for me, advocacy. It just became something that they could easily do and perhaps gain political goodwill.
And how's it been returning to, well, some sort of normal life, although I guess events this week reminded you that things will never be quite normal?
I'm stronger and better than ever before. I have lots of reasons to live better, not bitterly. And I try to do justice to freedom in everything. Being with my family is the best. I've been hitting the ground sprinting to rebuild this shattered life, but always with the line in mind, which is the worst day in freedom is better than the best day in detention.
Given all that you've said and all that you've been through, how should a country like Australia and indeed the West more generally deal with China?
Australia has this very difficult balancing between security and prosperity and, of course, our values. As a middle power, it's very difficult, as we saw. How do we deal with this stronger and more belligerent China when it does things like this? Despite what happened, it makes me more confident about a system of freedom, because we do debate uncomfortable and inconvenient incidents. And in China, you know that there's no mention of me at all in the Chinese internet sphere, right? A friend of mine tried to send me a link on WeChat about me, but because my WeChat had been registered in China, I can't see it. But because his WeChat was registered in Australia, he can see it. That's something I worry about, that this younger generation, if they don't use VPN or go abroad to study and live, then they just think that it's only the Western countries bullying China and all that propaganda.
That was Cheng Lei speaking to my colleague James Menendez. You've been listening to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks very much for your company and good night.